My name is Jim Dingman. This is a special to deal with the situation in the Gulf. You are just listening to Hussein Farjami, The Road to Esfahan. That's Santur music. We're going to be talking about the situation and crisis in the Gulf. We're going to have a whole range of guests with us, and it will include Gary Sick, Irvan Dabrahamian, Molly Noland, John Prados, Medea Benjamin, Christopher Dietrich, and Roland Marconi. I want to first, though, introduce the first guests before we play the first clip. Gary Sick will be on air with us for a half hour. He served in the National Security Council of President Ford, Carter, and a little time with President Reagan. He's a retired captain in the U.S. Navy. He's the executive director of the Gulf 2000 Project at Columbia University. He is an emeritus chair of the Middle East Institute, and he was still in charge of the University Seminar at Columbia on the Middle East. He's the author of The October Surprise and All Fall Down. He is also a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. Gary, are you there?
I am here indeed. Good to be with you, Jim.
Thank you, Gary. We also have Irvan Abrahamian in studio. Irvan Abrahamian is the Emeritus Professor of History at CUNY on Middle Eastern and Iranian Studies. Irvan has taught at Oxford, Columbia, Princeton, and CUNY. He taught at the Baruch College of CUNY for, 30 years, right?
42 years.
And he's an author of many books on the subject, including Iran Between Two Revolutions, A History of Modern Iran, which is published by Cambridge University Press. It's in its fourth edition. He did a book on the coup of Mossadegh, the coup 1953, the CIA, and the roots of modern U.S. relations. We also have in studio Molly Nolan, who's a professor emeritus of history at New York University. She taught at Harvard and Columbia University. She was the chair of the history department at New York University, and she's the author of numerous books and papers that I will not cite. Of course, they're too numerous to cite. She recently was an editor of the Handbook of the Global 60s, and Molly is a general overall specialist. She was a founder of the Cold War Seminar at New York University, and we're very pleased to have Molly here with us in studio today. Thank you for joining us, Molly.
Thank you for having me, Jim.
And later, we'll be joined by Michael McPherson for a short New York Minute. Michael McPherson is the Executive Director of Veterans for Peace. Michael is a graduate of Campbell University in North Carolina. He's a former co-chair of the St. Louis-based Don't Shoot Coalition, formed after the death of Michael Brown in Ferguson. He himself was on active duty. He was a field artillery officer in the U.S. Army, served in the Gulf War in the 24th Mech Division. And Michael will join us. He is the executive director of Veterans for Peace. But before we do that, let's hear a clip of the news that has occurred in the past few days. This is from Channel 4 News from England.
Iran has warned tonight that within days it will breach the limit on its stockpile of enriched uranium, a central element of the Iran nuclear deal, but added there was still time for European countries to prevent this by providing protection from US sanctions. This was met by accusations of nuclear blackmail from the White House. It comes a year after the US President Donald Trump abandoned the nuclear deal himself, and at a time when tensions between the two countries are rising over attacks on oil tankers in the Persian Gulf. Here's our foreign affairs correspondent, Jonathan Rugman.
It is a crisis which arguably began in Washington when President Trump labeled these Iranian Revolutionary Guards as terrorists back in April and tightened sanctions on their country. Then the Americans sent an aircraft carrier group and B-52 bombers to the Gulf, they said in response to an unspecified Iranian threat. Last month, President Rouhani announced that Iran was ramping up its nuclear fuel production, reducing its compliance with the deal that President Trump walked away from a year ago. And today, the Iranians chose one of their nuclear plants as the venue to announce that their supply of uranium will breach the deal's limit in 10 days' time, in what is a desperate bid to be allowed to sell oil. So desperate that a spokesman even delivered it in English.
There will be another set of actions if, after 60 days, they will not implement their commitments. We are suspending, we are not revoking the commitments, we are not removing the commitments.
Iran's economy is being crippled by U.S. sanctions, as the Americans are threatening any company anywhere which trades with Iran. The Chinese say they will defy Washington and carry on buying oil, but the Europeans have tried and so far failed to bypass the Americans. Today they said they would keep trying, amid fears the nuclear deal will collapse.
So our focus is not to enter into a blame game or giving responsibility for a collapse of a deal that might come. Our focus is to keep the agreement in place and keep the implementation of it.
When President Trump pulled out of the nuclear deal, his administration claimed that it had failed to stop the Iranians from testing missiles or supporting militants across the Middle East. Iran's response in the last few months has been typically defiant. The Americans and British blame it for attacking two tankers last week. This patrol boat, filmed by the Americans, is allegedly removing an unexploded mine from one of the ships.
It's unmistakable what happened here. These were attacks by the Islamic Republic of Iran on commercial shipping on the freedom of navigation with a clear intent to deny transit through the strait. This was on the Gulf of Oman side of the Strait of Hormuz. There's no doubt. The intelligence community has lots of data, lots of evidence. The world will come to see much of it.
The EU, though, has withheld judgment on assigning responsibility for these attacks, and Iran denies any involvement. Its army chief claiming today that if it ever wanted to block oil exports from the Gulf, it would not hide it.
If we decide to block the Strait of Hormuz, we will do it in a way that not even a drop of oil will get through.
Whatever the truth of what happened here, the Iranians are certainly threatening to act in the Persian Gulf and to abandon the nuclear deal if they can't sell their oil. The Americans already jettisoned that deal, and they're threatening action too. Both sides claiming they don't want a war, but at risk of starting one by mistake.
And you're listening to WBAI Radio in New York City, 99.5 at WBAI.org. My name is Jim Dingman. Next up after us is City Watch at 1 o'clock. We're doing a special on the crisis in the Gulf, and we have online with us Gary Sick from Columbia University, Ervand Abrahamian, and Molly Nolan. They're all very well informed and knowledgeable about this. We'll be joined with Michael McPherson, the Executive Director of Veterans for Peace. But first, we want to hear from the extremely stable genius, Mr. Trump, whose comments last week on this are worth putting into the mix.
Made a mistake. I would imagine it was a general or somebody that made a mistake in shooting that drone down. And fortunately, that drone was unarmed. It was not, there was no man in it, and there was no, it was over international waters, clearly over international waters, but we didn't have a man or woman in the drone. We had nobody in the drone. It would have made a big difference, let me tell you. Would have made a big, big difference. But I have a feeling, I may be wrong, and I may be right, but I'm right a lot. I have a feeling that it was a mistake made by somebody that shouldn't have been doing what they did. I think they made a mistake. And I'm not just talking to the country made a mistake. I think that somebody under the command of that country made a big mistake.
You're talking to Iran's leadership.
And we'll hear from the extremely stable genius again. This is a chronology of what happened on Friday.
So did you greenlight something, or had you said, if nothing we do it, I'll do this? What was the order you gave?
Nothing is green-lighted until the very end, because things change, right?
So and you never gave a final order?
No. But we had something ready to go, subject to my approval. And they came in, and they came in about a half an hour before. They said, sir, we're about ready to go. I said, I want a better
planes
definition.
Planes in the air? Were planes
no,
in the
we're
air?
We're about ready to go.
Yeah.
No, but they would have been pretty soon. And things would have happened to a point where you wouldn't turn back or couldn't turn back. So they came and they said, sir, we're ready to go. We'd like a decision. I said, I want to know something before you go. How many people will be killed? In this case, Iranians. Mm-hmm. I said, how many people are going to be killed? Sir, I'd like to get back to you on that. Great people, these generals. They said, came back, said, sir, approximately 150. And I thought about it for a second. I said, you know what? They shot down an unmanned drone, mm-hmm. plane, whatever you want to call it. And here we are sitting with 150 dead people that would have taken place probably within a half an hour after I said, go ahead.
Yeah.
And I didn't like it. I didn't think it was I didn't think it was proportionate.
And, of course, that's President Trump talking to Chuck Todd. That whole interview was broadcast on Meet the Press. That's an excerpt, a teaser that was leaked out on Friday. And we'll finally hear from the extremely stable genius comment yesterday before he went to Camp David. He's talking about how he wants to make Iran great again.
I'll be talking about Iran at Camp David, yeah. We have a series of meetings and, more importantly, a series of very well-connected phone calls. We have a great phone system up there, and as you know. So I'll be doing a lot of work. We may release it later. We may. Look, Iran right now is an economic mess. They're going through hell. The sanctions have hit them hard. More sanctions are going to be put on, a lot more. It's hard to believe you can even put on, but it's a mess. All I want is no nuclear weapons. Under the horrible Obama deal, he gave them $150 billion. He gave them $1.8 billion in cash. Think of that, in cash. Many plane loads of cash. Gave them $1.8 billion in cash, and he got nothing. But the thing he really didn't get was good inspection rights, because the most primary places you couldn't go to, you couldn't inspect. We haven't seen them in years. The other thing he didn't get is time, because in a very short number of years, they will legally be able to make a nuclear weapon. That's unacceptable. And remember this, the deal wasn't even ratified in Congress. It never got proper, in terms of treaty, it never got proper authorization from Congress. So with all of that, it was very important to me, so we'll start all over. We could have a deal with them very quickly if they want to do it. It's up to them. But if Iran wants to become a wealthy nation again, become a prosperous nation, we'll call it Let's Make Iran Great Again. Does that make sense?
Okay, so we had our comments by the stable genius. It was announced that there would be more sanctions on Iran. Merkel, the German prime minister, has been calling for a political solution to this. And obviously, next week, the G20 summit that will be discussed. We also had leaked that there has been an increase in cyber warfare, cyber attacks back and forth between the two sides, escalated particularly after the shootdown of the drone on Friday. And Tehran is reaching out to Oman. And other intermediaries. So there's a whole bunch going on, and we want to have people unpack it. Well, first of all, let's lead off with Gary Sick. Gary Sick is the former National Security Advisor for Carter Ford and runs the university seminar at Columbia University on the Middle East. And you're listening to WBAI Radio 99.5 FM in New York at WBAI.org. My name is Jim Dingman. Gary, what's your first take on what we've listened to?
Well, I mean, I think we had really a very incorrect description of what the JCPOA was, the Iran nuclear deal.
Tell us what the JCPOA is. What's that?
Well, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action was the agreement that was agreed to by the five permanent members of the Security Council plus the European Union. In 2016, in which Iran agreed basically to agreed absolutely to not pursue any nuclear weapons, and they also agreed to reduce their stockpile of fissile material and to reduce the number of centrifuges, to do away with a heavy water plant that had been under construction, and to eliminate it completely and to rebuild it according to different specifications. They also, as part of the deal, agreed to ratify the additional protocols of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is the most significant, the most complete inspection protocol that exists in the international, in the non-proliferation world today. So, and that was a permanent thing that they accepted. So they accepted to permanently not build a nuclear weapon, and that they would be under permanent inspections according to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But they didn't agree to change their ballistic missile program, and they didn't agree to do anything about their support of Hezbollah and so forth. And so President Trump is correct that they didn't promise to do any of that other things, but he's completely wrong about the fact that after a certain number of years, Iran can legally set about building a nuclear weapon. They cannot. And they absolutely agreed that they could not. That is in writing. That was in the preamble of the JCPOA. That was ratified in turn by the Security Council of the United Nations. And all countries unanimously voted in favor of it and was accepted in the United States. So Iran accepted and agreed never to build a nuclear weapon and that they would remain under the inspection regime of the Non-Proliferation Treaty of the IAEA. So he was very wrong in the way he described that. Basically, what we have here is a crisis of our own making, that basically if we had stuck with the JCPOA, we would have none of these things going on right now. Basically, the United States, by breaking away from it, and then basically punishing Iran and punishing all the rest of the world because they were, in fact, in compliance with the agreement, basically set off this crisis, and we are now seeing the results of it. And I think Iran's responses, whether one likes them or not, are the responses of a country that's being strangled. And so they are responding in a way that we don't like. And I think if I'm correct, the people in Washington are surprised that Iran is, in fact, able to respond this way. They were not expecting any opposition from Iran, and they thought that Iran really couldn't do anything about what was happening. The fact that Iran is able to interfere with oil prices, interfere with transportation going through the Gulf, and so forth, were, I think, not foreseen, and I think the shoot down of the drone was not foreseen. But we have gotten ourselves into a crisis situation in which basically it's a matter of war or peace, and all of this was really totally unnecessary.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Gary. Well, one of the things I want to ask Urbond is that when the Secretary of State Pompeo made the demands on Iran, which is essentially retreat completely from the Middle East. They put in command of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps as sort of a hard charger type who was pretty outspoken in his record so that one could actually see what Gary was talking about would probably be likely this kind of action would be done by Iran. But what's your take on what's happening with this in response to Gary's comments?
Well, I think actually Obama was right when he said that when Trump withdrew from the agreement, there are basically two alternatives left. One is a nuclear Iran. The other is war. Basically, it's clear cut from Obama's point of view. Those are the choices. And what I heard just now from the Trump statement is somewhat different from Gary, because here I see a somewhat backing down. The Pompeo demands, the 12 demands, were basically unacceptable. There's nothing to negotiate. I mean, the good Lord had only 10 commandments, and they're pretty hard to keep. He came up with 12 that are actually not even negotiable. But here, what I just heard was that Trump was saying that one of the problems with the agreement was that their inspectors couldn't go anywhere at any time. In fact, under the agreement, there are specific clauses about inspections. There are permanent inspections. But it's true that inspectors can't go anywhere at any time. There is a whole set network that if any member of the five plus one suspects there are secret programs, nuclear programs, they can request an inspection there at that time and get an agreement with the participants of the agreement to have inspectors. But there isn't a clause saying you can inspect anytime, anywhere. And Iran would never accept that because if you remember back when the Bush crisis with Saddam Hussein was, they wanted inspections anywhere, anytime, including Saddam Hussein's private bathroom because he might have nuclear weapons hidden away in his bathroom.
Well, that's so, where they were. Okay.
Yeah. So I don't know that the supreme leader in Iran is going to accept that. So that's not actually a feasible demand. But here actually is saying something concrete while the Pompeo's demands were very general. But again, this, I think, backing down or saying something more specific is not going to open the road to any sort of negotiations because, again, it's not acceptable to Iran. Mm-hmm. So we're left back with Obama's choice of either Iran going nuclear eventually because the sanctions are horrendous, or if it doesn't go, if the other choice is that basically a confrontation, military confrontation. And remember, America's main ally, Israel. For Israel, Iran as it is an existential threat. If Iran has a nuclear weapon, it's more than an existential threat. Mm-hmm. So there's that strong backing from Israel to get the Trump administration to actually militarily strike Iran.
Hmm. Well, we have Michael McPherson on the line. Michael, are you there? Michael?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Michael, sorry. Michael, what's your take on this as it's going on, as you're seeing it? What's the sort of, how do you see this as from the point of view of a former veteran who fought in the Gulf? And who's been involved with Veterans for Peace and other social justice organizations that deal with these issues for years.
Sure. And I'm sorry, I'm about to get on a plane, so I'm not going to have long. So one thing, just listening to the little bit that I was able to hear of the guests talking about how the Trump administration is surprised by Iran being able to resist in the way that it has. And that's extremely disturbing, though not surprising, because there's been other situations domestically where it seemed like the Trump administration was surprised that there was a certain type of reaction. So certainly if they can't even figure out things that you should be, any one of us can see, you know, just watching the news and understanding politics here at home, they don't have any way to understand what's happening in other parts of the world. And it's a shame that we have an administration that has to seems to have no analytical capabilities whatsoever. And that's disturbing in that, what else is going to happen that could possibly happen in our foreign policy? If you agree with them or not on certain aspects, there should be at least some kind of analysis and movement in a direction that makes sense rather than things just being in total disarray. So everyone, I think, if you agree with me or not about Iran or North Korea or whatever, you should be concerned about how this administration handles foreign policy.
And Veterans,
the next thing I would,
yeah, and Veterans yeah. for Peace, it just issued a statement about this, correct?
Right. Of course, we believe that we know we shouldn't be going to war with Iran, and we should not have pulled out of the agreement, and that these actions that the Trump administration are doing, that we can't even really trust what they're saying about the drone not flying in Iran airspace and all those things. There's nothing that they say that we should really take at face value. Another thing that bothers me as I watch the news is how there's only really political talk about what is going on as opposed to what it means in people's lives. What does it mean for a U.S. soldier, a U.S. service person to be involved in this war if we go to war with Iran, when we've been at war for 18 years and people have had multiple deployments? What does it mean to when we had a war in Iraq, which really is still going on? And Iraq is a very different country than Iran in terms of military capability, size, and all that. What does it really mean to go to war with Iran? And what does it mean to the Iranian people? You know, if it's Americans dying and Iranians dying, what does that really mean? There's no discussion of that. And that I'm not surprised by that, but at some point our country has to have these types of conversations. And then the last thing I wanted to say before I go is I would ask the average person just to think about, what has Iran done to us as a nation? In what way has Iran impacted your life that we should be going to war with Iran? You know, and if you think that there might be something you could come up with, which I would guess most people can come up with nothing, also look at what we've been doing lately, as your guest talked about, pulling out of the agreement, kind of pushing Iran into a situation where if it was the United States, our citizens would want our president to push back on a nation pushing, you know, us around. Wouldn't the citizens of Iran want the same thing? So I would just ask people to think about, if you were them, what would you be wanting your country to do? And what have they done to us? So those would be the things that I would ask people to think about.
Thank you, Michael. And where can one see the statement that Veterans for Peace issued?
If you go to our website, veteransforpeace.org, spelled out Veterans for Peace, F-O-R, for Peace, you can see it there.
Thank you very much, Michael. Have a good, safe trip. Molly, in terms of the wider context, the domestic, you know, we have, of course, Trump just pulled back on arresting people today in the United States. He issued that I'm going to arrest 2,000 people and millions last week. But you see that Merkel is intervening in here. And as I understand it, Germany is one of the biggest trade partners with Iran. So give us the wider perspective about how you see this.
Okay, the Europeans are very upset by American actions for several different reasons. The withdrawal from the Iran nuclear deal they see as part of a pattern of withdrawing from international accords to which it once signed, the Paris Climate Accord, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Force. They dislike the erraticness, the unilateralism of America. They also were deeply committed to the Iran nuclear deal. They monitored the inspections carefully. They insisted that Iran was adhering to the deal and feel that Americans were simply wrong in withdrawing and that their views were not taken seriously by the U.S. But there's a second reason that the Europeans are so upset. The U.S. is not merely imposing sanctions on Iran. They're imposing secondary sanctions against any businesses, banks, corporations, etc., that trade with Iran and claim that any of these will be prohibited from doing business in the United States. And much as Germany is one of Iran's major foreign trading powers, German trade with and investment in the U.S. is much greater. So the governments talk a good line, the British, the French, the Germans, the EU, that they continue to support the deal. But corporations are withdrawing. Siemens has withdrawn from planned investment in Iran. The French Total has withdrawn. Corporations are really cutting back. SWIFT, the privately owned Belgian firm that arranges international monetary transactions, has, under pressure from the U.S., eliminated Iranian banks from the system. So this is the American imposition of a kind of extraterritoriality of the sort that goes back to 19th, early 20th century imperialism. It's a kind of empire of sanctions. The Europeans are trying, but not yet at all successfully, to set up an alternative payment system that will circumvent systems like SWIFT and the dollar. On the Western side, it's the British, French, and Germans have set up INSTEX, the Instrument in Support of Trade Exchange. The Iranians have a mirror organization called the Special Trade and Finance Institute. In theory, this is going to enable goods to flow across borders, but import-export money to be, it's a little complicated and I can't explain it too clearly, to stay within each side.
Interesting.
It's supposed to start with humanitarian aid and then spread. So far, a year and some after the U.S. has withdrawn, nothing is actually functioning. So much as Iran is right to say, Europe, you have got to act, putting too much hope in that is, I think, regrettably unrealistic.
And you're listening to WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM at WBAI.org. My name is Jim Dingman. We're doing a special on the crisis in the Gulf. You just heard Molly Nolan. Gary, before you go, what comments do you have on all this?
Well, there are a couple of things that I'd like to just double down on a little bit. And one of them is that there's this contradiction of terms, which the government, the U.S. government, basically says that Iran is the greatest threat to world peace that exists, and keeps harping on that theme. And at the same time, they seem to be functioning on the basis that Iran can do nothing to us at all. And so on one hand, they're the great threat. On the other hand, they're no threat at all. And we're surprised when they actually respond to some of the things that we do, that we were supposed to be able to just sit this out. And I think that says something about sort of where we're coming from as a nation in terms of the way we deal with Iran, what we anticipate. And I think the illusory aspect of our policy, and that is that it's based on a combination of wishful thinking and a sort of a complete rejection of the existing facts. The same way that the president described the nuclear deal is simply false. I mean, it simply is not what the deal says and not what it does. And we're operating on the basis as if we were, that basically his view of the deal is the new reality. And I think we really do have to beware of these kind of, illusory policy by wishful thinking and basically making things the way we want them to be. The other aspect of this is the fact that the United States has really entered into a period of what I would call just simple propaganda, that basically the way our policy is constructed and the way we present it to the rest of the world ignores all of the points that have been made here in this discussion today about all of the factual incorrectness of a number of the things that have been said. We don't address those at all. We simply go back, if you look at Pompeo and the speeches that he has made and the demands that he has made over and over and over again, he makes the same points, which in many cases are simply false, and at the same time totally ignores the opposition to those ideas or any challenge to those ideas. And as a result, we end up sounding like a sort of jingoistic nation where we basically are producing propaganda, but we're not really producing a sort of logical understanding of what the issues are and trying to deal with them. And to me, that is, that's really the essence of the problem, that if we are out to create some kind of credibility for ourselves with the rest of the world, we have to give the rest of the world some basis for accepting that we are a credible power. And I must say, in the way this has been handled, the biggest casualty thus far is not just the truth, it's American credibility. That basically, if President Trump really wants to do a deal with Iran, why would he think that pulling out of an existing agreement that was really where Iran made most of the concessions along the way, pulling out of that and punishing everybody who was involved with it, and pulling out, of course, many of the other agreements that we have been part of, why would any country think that they could do a deal with us? Why would you trust the United States to do a deal when, in fact, they have just shown that they're completely untrustworthy? And it may be that this is the way Trump does his negotiating, and this is his deal-making process of be tough on somebody and then do a deal at the end. But in this case, the real casualty along the way is American credibility, and it's hard to believe that anybody is going to believe that they can have a working relationship and basically do any agreements with the United States and have any confidence that the United States will fulfill its part of the agreement. And that's a long-term cost. That's not just the cost that goes into this particular crisis.
Well, thank you very much, Gary, for joining us. We look forward to having you on again. We've just been listening to Gary Sick, who is the person in charge of the Gulf 2000 project at Columbia University, the former national security advisor for President Carter during the hostage crisis. Thank you, Gary, for joining us.
It was a real pleasure. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to shift this in talking to Ervand and Molly. You know, let's look at the sanctions that have been imposed by the United States. And this is obviously not new. There were sanctions imposed by the United States after the overthrow of the Shah. But the sanctions in particular have had a devastating effect on the life of the average person. Molly was talking about the way the sanctions have been handled by Europe in terms of different provisos to provide food. As I understand it, when the nuclear deal came into effect, the JCPOA, their economy went up 12%, and now it's gone down by 6%. The oil output at the time of the deal was about 3.8 million barrels a day. Now it's down to 1.1 billion barrels a day. And the sanctions that are being imposed, their objective is to essentially knock out the exceptions that were in the different waves of sanctions to allow oil to come out of the country. You also have inflation going up. You have several million people in Iran are living on $1.90 a day. So what do you what's Ervand, and it's a sort of sanctionitis in American foreign policy. We can achieve regime collapse by imploding them economically and politically, which is clearly what they want to do. And you have another issue in here, and you have the sort of neocon sort of extraordinaires of the National Security Advisor in the realm of someone like John Bolton, but even more important, the shift in alliances with Saudi Arabia. And I wonder if you could bring that into the picture. How do you see Saudi Arabia factoring into this?
Well, Saudi Arabia has made it quite clear from ever since the change of basically rulers there that Iran is a stake and it has the head has to be cut off. And they're volunteering America to do the dirty job, basically. They're using you as a mercenary to do that. So their policy is, I think, quite decisive. But going back to the sanctions, I'm sure privately what Bolton and Pompeo are telling Trump is these sanctions are so tough and the Iranian regime is so fragile that the regime will actually collapse. So U.S. doesn't have to go to war. If you just persist on the sanctions, the system itself is basically will unravel. And then you have people like the Mujahideen who basically have very good ties with this administration.
Tell people who the Mujahideen are.
The Mujahideen are basically a group that it's a cult group that until recently was categorized by the U.S. as a terrorist group. It's been decategorized, but it's well-funded probably by the Saudis. So they have billions of dollars they spend. People like Giuliani, Bolton, receive money from them. So their argument is that the regime is illegitimate, weak, it'll collapse. In fact, Bolton told the Mujahideen that within a year they'll be in Iran, probably supposedly ruling the country. But the fallacy in this argument that the system will collapse is the notion that this is a very weak state. Again, what Gary mentioned, there's this contradiction. On one hand, Iran is a major threat. On the other hand, it's a very fragile, weak state that if you huff and puff and put some sanctions, it will collapse. The problem with that is that, sure, the sanctions hurt, especially hurt ordinary people who are sick and need medicine and so on. The economy will not grow. But that's not going to bring down the regime for a number of reasons. The state, Iranian state, is quite actually functionally, bureaucratically pretty efficient. During the Iraqi war, where there were very strict restrictions, shortage of money, they introduced things such as rationing and made sure that the average person was not actually deprived of essential goods. So they have the civil service system, like Britain during World War II, to introduce rationing that will actually cushion the pain. Another problem with this notion that the regime is fragile, the thing is, this regime does, whether you have criticism of it and it has a lot of problems, it is legitimate. It came to power with a massive popular revolution 40 years ago. And even people who are critical of it don't want the destruction of the regime. So when you have outside pressure, people are going to more likely rally around the regime rather than try to undermine it. So I think the real danger of the Pompeo-Bolton notion is that if you put the sanctions on, the regime is not going to collapse. If it doesn't collapse, then what's their next step? Since they're determined to get rid of the Islamic Republic, the next logical step for people like Trump and Bolton would be to actually go into military activities, because their, I think, goal, or the long-range goal, is the end of the Islamic Republic.
Yes, absolutely. And Molly, we're talking, by the way, with Irvan Abrahamian. This is a special on the situation in the Gulf. My name is Jim Dingman. This is WBAI 99.5 FM radio at WBAI.org. We're talking with Irvan Abrahamian, retired professor from CUNY, author of many books, and Molly Nolan, also emeritus professor from NYU. Molly, what's your take on this?
Well, it seems to me an example of wistful thinking, magical thinking on the part of the U.S. That sanctions are going to work. How long have we had sanctions against Cuba? How long have we had sanctions against North Korea? What happened in Iraq in the 1990s? Most recently, what's happened with sanctions against Venezuela? There's always this imagining that we have so much economic power that we can punish countries and get what we want. What we can do is punish them. And make no bones about it, these sanctions are incredibly punitive to the poor, to the elderly, to children, to anyone with any kind of illness. We saw it in Iraq. We're seeing it in Venezuela. It's undoubtedly happening in Iran as well. But that is where American power is, to punish, but it's not getting what it wants. And then the question is open, what will happen next? I wanted to pick up on one thing that Gary Seek had said about credibility. American credibility in Europe is deteriorated massively, in part because of U.S. actions vis-a-vis Iran, but in general, this sense of unreliability on the one hand. Americans may sign an agreement today and back out of it tomorrow, but also they're very upset by Americans' willingness to wage economic warfare against Europeans, with tariffs on steel and aluminum threatening them on automobiles. Europeans increasingly feel they're lumped in the same category of those who the U.S. defines as rivals, competitors, or enemies. So the U.S. global reputation is deteriorating, and Iran is central but not the only piece of this eroding credibility.
And then, of course, you have the former advisor to the president, Mr. Bannon, going off and organizing essentially a neo-fascist popular front movements in Europe and globally. But before we continue, we're going to listen to, once again, Hussein Farajami wrote Isfahan. We're going to be joined with Medea Benjamin, who's involved in a demonstration right now in front of the White House.
Thank you.
listening to WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM in New York City, also streaming at WBAI.org. My name is Jim Dingman. We're doing a special on the Gulf crisis. I have in studio with me Irvan Dabrahamian, noted historian of Iran and the Middle East, and also Molly Nolan, who is a general historian of the 60s, women's history, etc. And we have on with us Medea Benjamin, who is the co-founder of Code Pink. She's sometimes called the Green Party Secretary of State. I guess she's a Secretary of State for a lot of us.
We want to start organizing in Congress every single day, where we're going to the offices of our Congress people and our senators, and then also mobilize for a bigger demonstration here in Washington, D.C., against going to war with Iran. I also think it's important to step up our expectations about what Congress can do. Even some of the best Congress people have not been good enough, clear enough, strong enough about what they're going to do to make sure that this administration doesn't drag us into a war. We want everybody to be on record, have it up on their website, put out videos, tweets, and of course sign on to resolutions that are already in Congress. But the bills and the resolutions in Congress are all about saying that Trump does not have the authorization to go to war without first going to Congress. We think it should be much more than that, and to recognize that the economic sanctions are a form of warfare, that they are already in place. While this latest strike Trump said he didn't do because he didn't want to, that the casualties were disproportionate, what about the casualties that are happening every day from the economic warfare? And so we want Congress people to come out, not just saying we don't want the president to invade Iran without going to us first. That's very weak. We want them to say no military intervention in Iran, lift the economic sanctions, and rejoin the Iran nuclear deal.
Medea, give us a little sense of your take on what's going on in Yemen, because obviously this is interrelated. The whole situation there has been exploding for the past few years. Just describe to us how you see this in the context of what's happening now.
Well, this is an example of the U.S. support for the Saudi regime. Some analysts say that the Obama administration got us involved with the Saudis in the war in Yemen back in 2015 when the Iran nuclear deal was signed. And this was a way of saying, well, you know, yes, we've given going against your wishes and the wishes of Israel, but as a SOP, we will support you in the war in Saudi Arabia, acting as if the Houthis were under the command of Iran. Iran did not tell the Houthis to rise up. In fact, many say that Iran advised them not to do so. They have been supporting them since then, but that's because the Saudis have gone in and created such a catastrophic situation in Yemen. So while we make demands on our government not to get us involved in a war in Iran, we should, as you are doing, connect it to the catastrophe that already exists in Yemen and is ongoing with U.S. weapons. And it is good that Congress has said we want to stop weapon sales to Saudi Arabia, but this has been overridden by Trump, so we have to get more people in Congress to support a cutoff in weapons to Saudi Arabia, as other Western democracies are starting to do around the world. Way too late, and it shows their hypocrisy of valuing money for weapons companies over the lives of people in Yemen, but at least we're starting to gain traction to call out Congress and say no more weapon sales to Saudi Arabia.
And of course, in Yemen, a population of 28 million, 7 million people are affected by famine, 17 million people need food assistance, 3 million plus have lost their homes. I want you to talk about what you see with Trump's policy towards Israel. For example, in December of 2017, he recognized Jerusalem as the Israeli capital, something that has long been considered a verboten type of red line to cross in American foreign policy. How do you see, and of course he then reinforced Netanyahu's election campaign in the spring of this year by his announcement of sanctions against Iran. How do you see that in interplaying with all this?
Well, these two supposedly strange bedfellows, Saudi Arabia and Israel, have a common adversary, and that is Iran. And they are pushing the U.S., both of them, goading the U.S. into a war with Iran. Israel does not want to get in a war with Iran itself because it knows what a strong military Iran has, but they certainly want the U.S. to do that. And we see just yesterday John Bolton in Tel Aviv meeting with Bibi Netanyahu and saying, we're not done with Iran yet. Just because we didn't make that strike, don't think that we're going to be weak on Iran, that we are announcing new sanctions against Iran. The Israelis are pushing the U.S. to push Iran into a corner so that they have to do something like leave the Iran nuclear deal, because why should they stay in a deal that is providing zero benefits for them? And then the Israelis will say, look, they're pulling out of this deal. This is an existential threat to your great ally, Israel. You've got to go in and bomb them. And let's recognize that Israel has nuclear weapons. We don't know how many because they will not reveal it, but some say 200. They have never joined the Non-Proliferation Treaty. They would never allow the kind of inspection regime that Iran agreed to. And yet it is Israel that is pushing the United States to go to war with Iran over Iran's non-existent nuclear weapons.
Well, thank you, Medea Benjamin. Medea Benjamin is the co-founder of Code Pink. She's the author of a new book, Inside Iran, The Real History and Politics of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Where can one find out information?
In general, you can go to the Code Pink site and sign up, and we send out alerts every week about what people can do to stop a war with Iran. So thank you so much for having me on and the great work that you are doing there at WBAI. To keep us out of another disastrous war.
Well, I want to thank you and all your colleagues for the great fun it is to watch your courage in Congress all the time. Thank you so much.
Okay. Have a good day. Bye-bye.
And we're next going to hear from Mehdi Hassan, who is going to be giving an introduction to, and a little short pressy, to the coup in 53 that overthrew Mossadegh, because, of course, political memory, look at how we're arguing about slavery. We're arguing about the Civil War. We argue about World War II. Well, of course, in Iranian political memory, the overthrow of Mossadegh is a big deal. So this is important to keep in mind what happened. This is a piece that was done by Mehdi Hassan of Intercept. It's part of a six-part series called Blowback. And this is a little pressy to the Mossadegh coup of 53.
Ever since the revolution of 1979, US presidents have viewed the Islamic Republic of Iran, under the rule of the Ayatollahs, as a threat and as an enemy, and the feeling's pretty mutual.
Iran's leaders have shown only a clenched fist.
America and England, look at them. Every dictatorship and terror and human destruction is in their hands.
For decades, Iran has fueled the fires of sectarian conflict and terror.
Death to America, Khamenei told the audience, because America is the original source of this pressure.
But what if it was blowback from U.S. policies that helped the Ayatollahs take over in the first place? Americans often ask, why can't Iran have a secular democratic government? Well, they kind of did, and it was the U.S. that helped get rid of that government and paved the way for the Ayatollahs and the Islamic Revolution. You have to go back to 1953 and the coup against Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who was democratically elected. A former Time magazine man of the year, the populist Mossadegh had a great deal of support from ordinary Iranians. He reduced the powers of the autocratic king, the Shah, and nationalized the Iranian oil industry. That upset the British, who had been in control of Iran's oil, and they decided to take action.
We should not allow the biggest foreign asset in Britain to go without doing something about it.
The sooner, then, that he left power, the better for Persia. Not for us, for Persia.
Right. So the British persuaded the Americans, in the form of the Eisenhower administration, to join them in getting rid of Mossadegh.
The British understood the extent of paranoia in this country concerning communism. This was the day of Joe McCarthy. and that the British consciously played on that fear in order to help persuade us to involve ourselves in the coup.
Mossadegh was not a communist, but he did have the support of the country's Communist Party. So the CIA, just 6 years old, swung into action. CIA agent Kermit Roosevelt, grandson of President Theodore Roosevelt, arrived in Tehran in July of 1953 to implement Operation Ajax. Thanks to declassified CIA documents, we now know the details of that plan included persuading the Shah to sign two decrees, sacking Mossadegh and replacing him with a pro-American general, paying mobs of protesters to take to the streets and start anti-government riots, and funding a propaganda campaign to portray Mossadegh as a pro-Soviet communist.
That mob that came into North Tehran and was decisive in the overthrow was a mercenary mob, had no ideology, and that mob was paid for by American dollars.
By August, Mossadegh had been forced from office, and the Shah was back in full control.
I owe my throne to God, my people, my army, and to you, the jubilant Shah told Roosevelt and the CIA, as he kicked off a 26-year period of brutal dictatorship, which would end up sparking the Islamic Revolution in 1979.
By the way, none of this is disputed anymore. The Clinton administration fessed up in 2000.
The Eisenhower administration believed its actions were justified for strategic reasons. But the coup was clearly a setback for Iran's political development.
But even when U.S. leaders openly admit to the U.S. role in the Iranian coup, they try and play it down. Here's Barack Obama speaking in 2015.
We had some involvement with overthrowing a democratically elected regime in Iran.
Some involvement? Some involvement? Seriously? It may have been a British idea, but the coup itself was instigated, organized, executed, and financed by the CIA. And here's a key point, a bit a lot of people seem to be unaware of. Declassified documents seem to suggest the CIA also worked with hardline members of Iran's Shia clergy, including Mossadegh's one-time ally, Ayatollah Abul Qasem Kashani, the Speaker of Parliament, and they worked with him to help bring down that secular democratic government and bring back the Shah. See, a lot of Shia clerics back then weren't happy about Mossadegh's alliance with the communists or his generally secular outlook. And so both the CIA and Britain's MI6 offered to fund those clerics, including the powerful and influential Ayatollah Kashani. Ayatollah Kashani was a mentor to Ayatollah Khomeini. Yes, the same Khomeini who would later topple the despised Shah and found the theocratic and anti-American Islamic Republic of Iran in 1979.
Mossadegh back in 1953. Nobody knows who Mossadegh was. Democratically elected prime minister of Iran. He was overthrown by British and American interest because he threatened oil interest of the British. And as a result of that, the Shah of Iran came in, terrible dictator. As a result of that, you had the Iranian revolution coming in, and that's where we are today. Unintended consequences.
Unintended consequences, or what's known in the intelligence business as blowback. In fact, the very concept of, the very term blowback, was first coined by the CIA in relation to Iran in a secret internal report on lessons learned from the coup against Mossadegh. A coup, remember, that backfired and yet nevertheless became a model for later CIA interventions from Guatemala to Chile. And whether it's coups, assassinations, invasions, more than 60 years later, the US is still in the regime change business with all of the attendant chaos, extremism, bloodshed, and blowback. I mean, the current U.S. administration is talking about regime change in Iran. Again.
Our policy towards Iran is to push back on this hegemony, contain their ability to develop, obviously, nuclear weapons, and to work towards support of those elements inside of Iran that would lead to a peaceful transition of that government.
Are you kidding me? As Michael Morell, a former deputy director of the CIA, has pointed out, not only are you unlikely to be successful, but you're likely to have huge blowback. Yes, blowback. But is anyone in government even listening?
And you're listening to WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. My name is Jim Dingman. We're doing a special on the crisis in the Gulf. I have in studio with me Molly Nolan, who is a professor of history emeritus at NYU. We also have Irvand Abrahamian, who's a professor of history from CUNY. We're joined in studio with Roland Marconi, who is the director of Enemies of Peace, Preventing the Next War in the Middle East, which has been shown on Free Speech TV, and I believe it was a premium here at WBAI. I think it was shown downstairs too, right, Roland?
Yeah, we had a screening last November.
Okay, and we're also joined on the line with John Prados, who's a senior fellow at the National Security Archive in Washington, D.C. He received his doctorate from Columbia University. He has written 20 books, and his latest book is on Langley, Into the CIA Heart of Darkness. He received prizes for various books, including Valley of Decision, The Siege of Quezon, with my favorite Marine chaplain, Naval Chaplain Ray Stubbe of the 26th Marine Regiment. We also have Christopher Dietrich online, Associate Professor of History at Fordham University. He is a foreign affairs historian. He's done a recent book, Oil Revolution, Anti-Colonial Elites, Sovereign Rights, and the Eco Culture of Decolonization, published by Cambridge University Press. He's writing a new book, Fear of the Dark, American Nationalism and Foreign Oil in the 20th Century. But before we go to that, I want Ervan to respond to this piece on the Mossadegh coup, since Ervan has done a book on the coup against Mossadegh in 1953. Ervan.
Yes, I think the general outline of the coup is pretty well now established. There's no doubt about it. There is still this issue, I think, how much the coup was about the Cold War, how much is to do with oil. The justification even now given is that while it wasn't a good idea, it had unforeseen circumstances, but you have to understand it was during the Cold War, and of course anything to fight communism is justifiable. But if you look at the documents at the time, the real concern, not just in London but in Washington, was what would happen if there was a successful nationalization of oil industry. And this affected America as much as Britain. And this was very clear for the American oil companies. So if Iran nationalized successfully, this could easily inspire basically Venezuela, Indonesia, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, other countries to also basically follow that road. So from the very beginning, even the Truman administration did not want a successful nationalization of oil. So there wasn't a big difference between the British and the Americans about this. Where this basically there was some difference was how soon U.S. came around to the idea of actually carrying out a coup. The American strategy was to bring down Mossadegh through political means. So they wanted regime change, but through parliament. But when that became clear that that wasn't going to succeed, they went along with the British notion of a military coup. But on the whole, the notion that somehow America was there, even-handed on this issue between Britain and Iran, and the British, the perfidious British sort of hoodwinked United States to go to for a coup because of they inflamed the notion of communism, that the country was going to become communist if it didn't have a coup. This is a convenient, basically, argument to use, but there is no substance to it. The CIA documents at that time make it clear that there was no real communist danger in Iran. But despite all that, Dulles, Roosevelt, they wanted a coup basically because of the oil issue. Here, I think there's still much, you know, you can say nuance about what the U.S. motivations were, but it's convenient to bring in the Cold War because that then gets out the economic issue that the U.S. was involved. U.S. Historians of U.S. foreign policy usually try to avoid anything to do with economic motives for United States foreign policy, and oil is obviously an economic motive. And sometimes the straw argument is made that, well, what U.S. wanted was to replace the British in Iran. That wasn't the issue. The real fear that the American oil companies had was what would happen if the nationalization succeeded, that was a direct threat to all their interests.
Interesting. And of course, when you raise the issue of the lack of attention to political economy in American foreign history relations, that of course has been going on for decades. That's an intellectual drop down. And that gives us a great opening for Christopher Dietrich. Christopher, as you know, 19 million barrels a day go through the Gulf of Hormuz. And one of the things that's happened in this complicated situation is when the sanctions have reduced the export of oil from Iran to the various markets it was going to, down from 3.8 million barrels a day down to 1.1. Guess who took up the slack? The United Arab Emirates and Saudi Arabia. So I wanted you to share with us some of your insights into the global political economy of oil and how you see this in this particular situation.
Right. I think here we can pick up on something that Urban just mentioned, and this is the fear of Iranian nationalism and any sort of efforts to nationalization, that those can lead to some sort of domino effect that will then upset the stability of the international political economy. And this idea of stability and world economic health is something that we see invoked all the time by U.S. foreign policymakers. Pompeo made a statement earlier in the week that the United States stands for peace and stability and protecting American interests and Americans worldwide. This is similar to statements by Zbigniew Brzezinski right after the Iranian Revolution and the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, or George Shultz during the tanker wars, during the Iran-Iraq war in the 1980s. And oftentimes, the United States seeks to invoke stability as a rationale for a greater American military presence. And I think it's important to ask ourselves whether or not war with Iran or continued militarism in the Middle East really does advance U.S. interests. Is the Strait of Hormuz as much of a global choke point as it seems to be when we listen to what Gary Sick referred to as the jingoistic propaganda of different U.S. administrations? I don't think it is. I don't think that this sort of policy advances U.S. interests or the interests of the international economy, in particular the stability of the international economy.
And Roland, your movie, Enemies of Peace, Preventing the Next War in the Middle East, you take a pretty broad regional look at all the different conflicts. How are you seeing this situation that we're seeing unfolding right now in relationship to the film you did? And just give our audience a little background as to where they can see this film if they want.
Yes, well, this is actually a film that I've produced last year. And I was kind of predicting a lot of the things that are sort of coming to pass now. What I did was basically to give a forum to some of leading, what I feel are some of the leading journalists on the subject, who have been doing excellent work but have been totally marginalized in the mainstream or corporate media, who we see even up until this weekend have been kind of woefully lax in how they're addressing the subject. So a lot of it has to do with who's behind a lot of these actions and these policies, and what we're seeing is a lot of their think tanks and foundations that are funded and are also our Congress people as well, that are funded by foreign entities, especially United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, Israel, of course, and the influence that they have on our foreign policy. And we can see that directly with Trump and his family, with Pompeo, with Bolton, and we're seeing some of the effects of that now. It's just ramping up slowly. But it was a primary focus of the film that Iran is the main target that the U.S. is going after next. And, of course, the war in Yemen is featured heavily in the film, and the catastrophe that's going on there. And just what are some possible solutions in reviving a peace movement, in getting Congress to act. And we saw that they did act, you know, to try to invoke the War Powers Act to stop the bombing and the funding of the war in Yemen. But, you know, there's resistance, of course, on the Republican side and on the administration side. So we've been airing this film. It's been on Free Speech TV. There's a YouTube channel, Enemies of Peace, that has a lot of clips from it. And if you go to enemiesofpeacefilm.com, you'll see more information and where to view it as well.
Thank you, Roland. And we've been talking with Roland Marconi, director of Enemies of Peace, Preventing the Next War in the Middle East. One thing, of course, that's interesting in all this is how early on the Trump family got into the mix. Jared Kushner meeting with the Crown Prince in 2017, and essentially, as I understand it, getting a loan or seeking a loan to deal with 666 Fifth Avenue debt problems. Quite amazing stuff. John, we have John Protos on the line, a senior fellow at the National Security Archive. John, one thing that happens in all this is that immediately people go to the Gulf of Tonkin. They raise the question of what just happened in this situation in terms of this drone being shot down. And of course, as we know, the P-8A, the Orion, is working in tandem with that UAV, that unmanned air vehicle that was shot down. And we're having a big fight about, you know, what's the path, not the path, et cetera. Of course, ignoring the fact that we're in the middle of forcing them to the wall with our policies that would make them want to act in a way to boost the price of oil by raiding tankers and encouraging little kinds of operations like that in the Gulf. But what's your opinion on the analogies between the Gulf of Tonkin, or lack of analogies, in what we're seeing right now with, as we heard the extremely stable genius earlier talk about how he actually pulled back when he saw that his estimates were that 150 people would be killed?
Right. Well, I think that there are some interesting parallels between the Gulf of Tonkin and this current situation, but some actually that run in a direction different from now versus then. One similarity is this business of where was the drone, and was this an appropriate response on the part of the Iranians as opposed to the Americans? It's clear from what we see in terms of the claims of both sides of the location of the drone when the Iranians shot at it, that there is a potential that the drone was in Iranian airspace and therefore a legitimate air defense target. This, by the way, goes through the Gulf of Tonkin in the sense that at the time the United States unilaterally endowed nation states with a certain length of territorial waters, or I should say depth of territorial waters, of 3 miles, whereas the Democratic Republic of North Vietnam claimed 12 miles of territorial waters. The U.S. destroyers that were involved in that incident were actually under orders to approach a certain North Vietnamese island to at a distance of 8 miles, which, if North Vietnam was going to enforce its territorial waters, put the U.S. destroyers, in fact, in North Vietnamese waters and not in international ones. So, in this sense, there's an ambiguous situation in terms of territorial claims and military operations that gives the Iranian action a certain legality in international law. Now, to pull out to a wider lens angle, those American things in 1964 at the time of the Gulf of Tonkin were carried out in pursuit of a covert operations plan that was called 34A and were part of an operation that intended to pressure the Democratic Republic of Vietnam. I would say today in the Persian Gulf, the different kinds of activities such as tanker attacks and whatnot, and this firing on the drone can be sort of accounted as part of that, put the shoe on the other foot. That is, the literal state, Iran, is carrying out a certain degree of covert operations, signaling to the West, signaling to the oil states and whatnot, that they want their share too. So if there's a covert operation going on here,
More likely than not, it's coming from Tehran.
And, of course, we have in the case of talking about covert operations, we have the tangible examples of the ambush in Avaz. Was it last a year or so ago where a shootout occurred where a parade of Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps troops were shot at and ambushed. Several dozen people were killed and wounded. And examples of that, which raise a question of what kind of covert operations are being mounted in conjunction with Saudi Arabia, the UAE, and the United States. Molly.
Well, there's a whole other issue here, and that is that this set of events is unfolding within, as you're actually referencing, a broader political context, which includes Iranian opponents of the current regime in Iran, you know, the MEK forces and the ones aligned with them, who have been wanting to do that kind of an operation for a long time. So there are many cards on this table, and it's really hard to read them.
And it's also interesting that when we look at the reports, we really don't know what happened in terms of the decision-making in the White House. It's sort of unusual for a president to essentially lay out in his mind immediately the different options that he had. But in one of the pieces the Washington Post wrote, it talks about how General Soleiman of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps was angry that the battery down there took the shot at the drone. Which reminds me of what one hears about the Gulf of Tonkin, that Giap and Ho Chi Minh were angry that somebody had ordered those PT boats out into the Gulf to fight with the Maddox and the Turner Joy. So that's sort of an interesting comparison to that. But Molly, you know, the question of this interrelationship of this domestic policy we're having, this xenophobia, this deliberate racism that starts right away when the president announces his candidacy in 2015, you know, let's throw everybody out, the rapists, et cetera. This internationalization of this, this is something I think is very important to sort of emphasize, this interrelationship between domestic and international policy that's going on at the same time. And I wonder what your feeling is about it.
Well, I think all too often commentators will say that what Trump stands for is an extreme nationalism, a protectionism. He's turning inward, make America great again by disengaging from the world. And I think what is clear is that the U.S. is very aggressively and unilaterally and often punitively engaged in a variety of fronts. Economic warfare first and foremost, but you see in Venezuela efforts at covert action for regime change. So I think it's really important not to buy into this Trump as isolationist, but to see him as an engaged unilateralist, eager to intervene and willing to risk war in many places. At the moment, the hotspot is Iran. It looked for a while like it might be Venezuela or North Korea. I think this is why it's imperative that people call their congressional representatives immediately and say no military intervention in Iran. And if you want your number of your congressional representative, it's 202-224-3121. That is the congressional switchboard. They will hook you up. It's imperative, not merely that Congress asked to have a say in whether or not to go to war. It's imperative that Congress explicitly speak out against going to war.
And you're listening to WBAI Radio 99.5 FM in New York, streaming at WBAI.org. My name is Jim Dingman. We're doing a special on the crisis in the Gulf. I have in studio with me Molly Nolan, Ervand Abrahamian, Roland Marconi, and online Christopher Dietrich and John Prados. Christopher, please jump in.
Yeah, I agree absolutely with what Molly just said about Trump as an engaged unilateralist. And I think that we need to remember that Pompeo and Bolton's rank Islamophobia is part, a really important part of that. And this leads us to another sort of blowback, which was mentioned earlier. And this is the blowback of the overall costs of American nationalism combined with militarism as it's plunged us into war and as has been rightfully noted, economic warfare. Not only do we have 800 bases encircling the Earth, and have spent around $6 trillion in the war on terror that's lasted almost 2 decades. We've also have to remember that that perspective, that foreign policy perspective, has outlasted its expiration date. We're looking at policies here that really came in power in response to crises of the 1970s. The energy crisis, the readjustment of oil prices in that period, and then, of course, as has been mentioned, the Iranian Revolution, and right after that, the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan. We're looking at an entirely different set of security problems now, and these policies that were, bad policies then are even worse today. So I think when we think about blowback, we need to look at different types of blowback, including the policies that the United States itself creates.
Roland, in terms of your take on this, with doing the work that you did, the interviews you did to do this documentary, what sort of stands out to you in terms of the summation of the ideas that you heard when you interviewed all these people?
Well, there's a number of different things, but primarily there's like an extremely active and overarching influence by the military-industrial complex and by certain foreign governments and their proxies to just hold our our government under their thumb, basically to have them to have us do their bidding. So that's why we're seeing ever escalating military budgets. That's why we're seeing the Congress is failing to really push for invoking the War Powers Act, and Trump seems to be just free to do whatever he's doing. So there's a lot of other influences that seems to be the main focus of what I got out of the film. I mean, there are people like Medea Benjamin who are offering solutions to that, as far as fighting the war machine. People like Max Blumenthal have a lot of, on the ground experience and great input on this. People like Stephen Kinzer, who know a lot about the history. So there's some great people I've interviewed on the subject. But it comes down to the failure of our Congress to act, to rein in the president and these reckless foreign policies that he's just going into hyperdrive with at the time.
Now, I don't disagree with a lot of this analysis, but I do think we need to make 2 points to keep this discussion on track. One of them being that the Congress has long since sort of vacated its role on war powers and permitted American presidents to do things, and that to reestablish that role today is going to require a ton of political clout. And the other being that in this particular situation, we have a president who is overriding his national security advisors, who are the people who represent these long-entrenched U.S. state interests. So there's an anomaly in this situation in that respect.
Thank you. Thank you, John. Thank you.
Okay.
Christopher.
Yeah, to build on that idea of the logic of foreign policy, I think we're oftentimes what the United States does is it looks for success stories to point to. So Germany and Japan have been mentioned. If we want to think about economic sanctions, we can think about the idea that the United States could make Chile's economy scream under Allende, and therefore bring about a positive regime change there for American interests. And I think one of the issues with politicizing that sort of foreign policy is that we forget all the harm that regime changes and nation building have done across the world, and we're sort of blinded to that. I'll add too that the United States is constantly looking for sort of authoritarian, quote-unquote, strongmen that will have pro-investment policies. And we can reach back into the early 20th century for that, too. The difference between the Mexican Revolutionary government and the Porfirio Diaz regime that came before it. Or in the 1950s with Libya, when that was seen as a safe alternative to sort of the radicalism in Iraq, especially after the 1958 revolution. So, yeah, I do think some of this is hardwired into how we understand a threat and how we perceive what American benefits are. And I think sometimes it blinds foreign policymakers to other options.
And we'll have to let Molly have the last word.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of regime change is trying to be engineered now via sanctions. And behind that is the continued imposition of structural adjustment policies via the IMF and World Bank, that the main aim is less a particular kind of political regime than creating a safe environment for American investment on terms that Trump considers fair.
Right. The structure of global capitalism. Well, we want to thank our listeners today. This is Jim Dingman. We had a special on the Gulf crisis. And you're listening to WBAI Radio 99.5 FM in New York, streaming at WBAI.org. We want to thank our guests today, Molly Nolan, Irvan Abrahami, and Roland Marconi, Christopher Dietrich, and others, John Prados, for joining us. Thank you so much.